To be honest, the removal of the McRib from the menu has affected my family because every Thanksgiving, my family would order a 50-piece chicken McNugget and 10 McRibs. It was like a tradition. And now it's like my family's holiday spirit's kind of messed up and broken.
One woman's quixotic campaign to bring the McRib sandwich to McDonald's restaurants in Santa Clarita. That story later on the show today. First, Donald Trump has been in an escalating war of words with China. He has frequently criticized trade policies with China as unfair, and he has called for a 45% tariff on their goods. And now he's picked a China hardliner, UC Irvine professor Peter Navarro, to head his new National Trade Council. We're going to look at what a protectionist trade policy with China would mean for California now, a state that does a lot of business with China, from movies to tech to agriculture, with Clayton Duby. He is the director of USC's U.S.-China Institute. Welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Good to have you. Okay, so Donald Trump has singled out China, and he says he wants to designate the country as a currency manipulator. He wants to maybe impose a 45% tariff on imports. What would this mean for our goods here in California?
Well, in part, it would be that we were fighting the wrong battle. If you were to impose something regarding the currency manipulation, the Chinese government has been trying to prop up the Chinese currency. So that's completely inappropriate. With regard to trade, if we were to start to impose these large tariffs on Chinese imports, first of all, there would be pushback from a great many American companies, because many of the products that come into the United States are wearing American brands. They're produced by American companies in China. So there would be pushback there. But there'd also be massive pushback from the retailers. Walmart, Target, Costco, all of these would line up, plus consumers, who would, of course, have to pay the higher prices for these things.
Mm-hmm.
Now, many of these goods are already being produced. The low-tech items, low-value items, are being produced in Bangladesh, Vietnam, and other lower-cost producers. But China could easily respond by starting to sanction American products, and particularly those from California, in tech, in entertainment, in travel, and in other areas that could have a big impact here.
Do you expect that they would then impose their own tariffs? That would be a given if the U.S. imposed tariffs on Chinese goods?
Not necessarily. What the first thing they would do would be to appeal to the World Trade Organization, and the United States would be held up for having violated those kinds of norms, to just impose tariffs without arguing that these products are being dumped or anything like that. To simply impose tariffs because you don't like the terms of trade is out of the World Trade Organization agreement that we are a party to, and in fact that we pushed hard to get China into, to try to impose rules on China and to try to have a venue where, when China violates policies, we can go to the WTO and say, this is inappropriate. We need this market opened, or we need less dumping, something like that.
Well, what does it signal to you that he has appointed Peter Navarro to head his National Trade Council?
Well, if personnel is policy, then he intends to follow through on all of the things that he said he would do during the campaign in terms of imposing these kinds of tariffs, in terms of wanting to negotiate with China one-on-one, so moving outside of the World Trade Organization to say we want to work these things out on a bilateral basis. And so he would be saying, he would be moving to implement policies that he has called for on the campaign trail.
Let's look at how some key California industries would be affected. You mentioned tech, but there's also a huge film industry. How would that be affected?
Well, it's hard to know. You know, again, this is purely speculative.
Yeah.
We don't know. In fact, appointing Peter Navarro may simply be a rhetorical gesture, because this whole trade council is something new. We do have a U.S. trade representative, and we have people who are experts on U.S.-China trade already in the employ of the government. So this is a new entity. So it may just be a rhetorical shot to try to send a signal to Beijing. But if this were to happen, and if China were to think we need to do something drastic, it's it's unclear whether or not they would choose to sanction entertainment or tech. And the problem with sanctioning entertainment is that you've got a lot of Chinese companies that depend on American product to put people in those seats. And the Chinese have been building theaters crazily, and so they need product that brings people in. The most recent film to hit big in China is this joint production called Great Wall, which is produced by China's greatest director, Zhang Yimou, and stars Matt Damon.
Okay, what about agriculture? I know we export a lot of products to China, including almonds and pistachios.
Well, that's right. In fact, almonds, in terms of value, is one of the top five products exported from California. And in fact, you can see advertisements for California almonds on the subway in Beijing. And so it is an established brand. So we have almonds, but we also have, and people aren't necessarily aware of this, we manufacture airplane equipment that's exported. We manufacture vaccines. We manufacture data machines, all kinds of things, including the machines that produce semiconductors. Those are made here in California and then exported to China. So it would have a giant impact. We last year did about $20 billion in business in terms of exports of goods and services to China, and this could be at risk.
Well, are they betting that because China does rely on so many American exports that they would be loath to impose tariffs on those exports?
Well, it is a little bit of a game of chicken, right? China wants the high tech, and in fact, Chinese companies have been investing here in California. So we have Alibaba, this giant tech company that has five offices, including one in Pasadena, here in California. We have Baidu, the giant search engine, has a research facility up in Silicon Valley. And so we see more and more of this. Biotech, also these kinds of investments. So they are coming in and getting access to technology this way by developing it here in California, using California talent, and then sending it back to China. At the same time, they are buying cameras, they're buying all kinds of things from California because of our expertise in these specialized fields, such as the kind of cameras that you use to make films, the kind of cameras that you use in scanners. You do all kinds of things with this.
It's interesting how integrated the two economies really are once you start to really look at it. Also in real estate, a large part of our real estate boom here in Southern California, at least, is fueled by Chinese investments. So if domestic policies hurt the Chinese domestic economy with the increased tariffs, would you see more investment here as people look for safe havens?
They might. They are already looking for those safe havens. Yeah. They may not, however, be able to get their money out. China has been imposing these hard currency controls, trying to restrict the outflow of investment. Now, we received something like $7 billion in corporate investment from China last year. We probably have received at least that much in terms of individual households buying condos, buying single-family homes, these kinds of things.
Clayton Dubey, director of USC's U.S.-China Institute, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure.
The small city of Clovis, population 108,000, has won a major court victory against the Shell Oil Company. A jury awarded Clovis $22 million over the cleanup of a toxic chemical found in the city's drinking water wells. The case is one of a few dozen that have been filed against Shell and Dow Chemical in California since the year 2000. And the chemical in question has been found in some L.A. County water sources. Joining us now to talk about the case is Fresno Bee reporter Andrea Castillo. Welcome.
Thanks.
All right, tell us about this chemical. It's called TCP?
Yeah, it's called, the full name is a bit of a mouthful, but it's 1,2,3-trichloropropane, but TCP. And it was a waste product from making plastic. It was used in these farm fumigants that companies like Shell and Dow made. And they were used, those fumigants were used to kill these little worms called nematodes.
Mm-hmm. And so this chemical seeps into the groundwater and gets into the drinking supply?
Right.
And what was the case against Shell? That they knowingly used this or propagated this fumigant knowing that it was dangerous?
Yeah, so Clovis was arguing that Shell acted intentionally and maliciously by including the TCP in its fumigant and failed to warn people about the risks of using it.
And what did Shell say?
Shell said that Clovis's water has been safe to drink and that its product ultimately helped California agriculture more than harming, like, so that the benefits outweighed the risks. And they also said that their labels adequately warned of the risks associated with it.
But I guess the jury didn't buy that.
Yeah, so the what the jury said was that Clovis residents were harmed by the design of the fumigant, that Shell did not prove that the benefits outweighed the risks, and that those risks were known or should have been known at the time that the product was sold.
Well, how were the residents harmed? Did they get sick?
Well, so that is not proven. What is proven, what has been tested, is that TCP causes cancer and kidney and liver disease in lab animals like rats and mice.
But not in humans yet. That's not proven.
That's not proven.
Although it is on the state's list as a carcinogen.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay. So, but it's not just Clovis, right? I mean, this TCP is used all over.
Right. So it was used extensively throughout California, and there are about 40 cases total that have been brought against the chemical companies.
And so how big a deal is it that this tiny town, 108,000 population, wins this big case against a multinational oil company?
Yeah, so it's a pretty big deal because this is only one of two cases that have actually gone to trial, and the other one, which was in Redlands, it lost. So for Clovis to win, this is the first time that a community has won a case against one of these oil companies for TCP specifically.
And so does that mean that these other 40 cases are going to go forward?
Well, so it's 40 total. So there are about 30 that are still pending. But it could have some effect on other cases, specifically what one of the lawyers told me, or what the lawyer for Clovis. He said that, because he's also representing the city of Fresno, and he said that this could have an effect on Fresno's case, the likelihood that Fresno's case will settle rather than go to trial as well.
So what will Clovis do with $22 million?
They're going to filter the water. So they're going to get some what's called activated carbon filters. It's just the type of filter that's used. And they will filter the water so that Clovis residents are no longer drinking TCP.
Is that like a Brita water filter?
Brita water filters actually use activated carbon as well. But it's not known. So they Brita water filters haven't been tested for TCP specifically, so it's not known to what level they would filter out the chemical. And so because the chemical is in some pretty low doses, so we're talking parts per trillion, it might not work.
But they're pretty confident their method will work.
Yes, these would be very large tanks using activated carbon filters, yeah.
Well, had they already put those in place once they discovered the TCP?
They had not. They are really expensive. They had some tanks that are used to filter other chemicals as well, but those were really old. So what Clovis said was that they could not use them because they wouldn't have worked anyway.
Okay, so why didn't they just turn off the water then if it's got this chemical that's deemed dangerous in it?
It's a growing city. The city of Clovis grew pretty rapidly even just in the last year, and they needed the water. And at the time that they filed the lawsuit, the contaminated tanks accounted for about one-third of the city's water supply. So they just couldn't afford to take them offline.
And given the drought and increased groundwater pumping, is there the fear that there is more of this chemical out there in other drinking supplies and other chemicals in the drinking water?
Yeah, definitely. The drought has increased the fear of the increase of chemicals in drinking water. And if you go on the State Water Resources Control Board's website, it shows actually which counties have TCP detected in their wells.
Now, has Shell said whether or not it will appeal this decision?
They have not. So representatives for Shell emailed me this morning and said that whether they will appeal is a matter for another day.
Andrea Castillo, reporter with the Fresno Bee. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Coming up, why straight rural men are having sex with other men. Maybe they're not straight after all. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brandt. New research has found that some men who consider themselves straight are having regular sex with other men, and not just in places like prisons or the military, in conservative suburban neighborhoods, in biker gangs, and in rural America. That's according to a new study from the University of Oregon. Jesse Singel has written about that study for New York Magazine. Welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, the study you covered was conducted by a PhD student at the University of Oregon. And what was the study? Who did he speak with? How did he find the men?
Yeah, the guy who ran it is named Tony Silva. Excuse me. He's a sociologist there. He recruited 19 men from the Craigslist Men Seeking Men for Casual Encounters section and basically just sort of asked them about their sex lives. And he found that a lot of them, despite having regular sex with men, identified as straight, which is a consistent finding not only in the rural areas Silva studied, but in all over the place. There are a lot of men out there who sleep with other men but don't want to be called bi or gay.
Well, when you say a lot, what is that number? I mean, he interviewed just 19 men.
Yeah, I think what I mean by that is that wherever researchers look around at basically gay scenes, they find a lot of men participating in those scenes, sexually at least, who don't identify as gay. I don't think there are sort of hard estimates on the number of men who do this.
They don't identify as gay, but they're acting gay, so, I mean,
right.
Are they just not admitting that they're gay?
Yeah. So what's been fun about writing about this is watching people freak out on Twitter about it, because there are sort of two ways to look at it. One is that your sexuality is defined by who you sleep with. That's a common sense understanding that certainly makes sense to me. Other people say that, you know, sexuality is more than just who you sleep with, and that people should have a right to self-identify in a sort of flexible way, even if that means identifying as straight and occasionally sleeping with other men.
Okay, and so he interviewed mainly rural men for this study. Why rural men?
So, as Silva had pointed out, there's been a fair bit of research on, you know, everything from men in the military who do this to biker gangs to conservative suburban areas, but he saw a gap in basically rural white men, and he found some sort of interesting differences between how they define their experience and how some of those other men did.
And what were those differences?
So basically, Silva talks about this idea of rural masculinity. So basically, think about stereotypes of a dude in flannel who's self-reliant, who's rugged. So whereas straight men in a frat who sleep with each other might describe it as bonding with their bros to try to become closer with them. In this case, sorry, I've got a cat here. In this case, they would describe, the rural men would describe it as helping a buddy out. Like almost in the same language, like they were lending them a spare part for a tractor or something. They used a language that fit right into their day-to-day lives as, you know, rural straight men.
I think your cat has something to say about that. But do they form relationships or is it just transactional?
So they would always frame it as like they didn't want serious relationships. That was part of how they reaffirmed their masculinity. But what Silva found is that some of them would actually spend a fair amount of time with regular hookup buddies. They would go shopping with them and spend the night. But when they then described those encounters, they would say, look, I don't want something serious. I don't want someone femme. They would describe it in this very sort of almost homophobic misogynistic way. They were just looking for something transactional.
So would they then say, oh, but I'm straight, and this just reinforces this idea that I'm straight because I'm not attracted to stereotypically gay men?
Yeah, exactly. So a couple of them did identify as bi. Some of them would use a sort of funny language, like one of them I think said, I'm straight but bi, but closer to straight. So they would say, because I'm not into stereotypically gay men, because I don't do things like go to gay bars, I'm straight. This is just a part of my life. For whatever reason, I'm not getting what I want from my wife because some of them were married, but I'm still straight.
And even though they say that, there doesn't seem like they're hiding it or they're ashamed of their double lives.
No, I mean, you have to imagine some of them live in communities where it's still pretty difficult to be, you know, openly gay. And this wasn't a representative sample. But from these little snippets of interviews, they seem to have what feels to them like a coherent, perfectly fine life and a perfectly fine romantic life. They really compartmentalize this as something other than homosexual behavior.
What surprised you most reading these interviews?
This idea, just because, I mean, you know, who am I to say? I'm a straight guy who lives in Brooklyn. But this idea that you can participate in gay sex and interpret it personally as this reaffirms your heterosexuality. And this is something that comes up, like, whenever anyone studies these communities. It's this really interesting counterintuitive idea that, you know, I think is responsible for some of the Twitter freakouts. It's just hard to sort of grasp that.
And you also read this book called Not Gay, Sex Between Straight White Men by a professor named Jane Ward. And she looks at other organizations where there are groups of people, as you mentioned, biker gangs, suburban conservative communities. And so that book has been a little controversial because, why don't you describe what the controversy is?
Yeah, I think, you know, this writer for the late lamented Gawker, Rich Jezwiak, pointed out that it's sort of politically problematic to say what Jane Ward says, which is, you know, I'm not going to judge these men for describing themselves as straight. I'm just going to, you know, recount their words. Because at a certain point, if you have all these men who are engaged in same-sex sex but identify as straight, it is politically problematic because in terms of sort of building rights for gay people or building a stronger LGBT community, I think writers like Jezwiak feel that these men sort of get to have it both ways. They get to be a little bit homophobic. They get to enjoy heterosexual privilege all while they're, you know, sleeping with men on the down low.
Well, I'm also wondering if they are also perhaps engaging in unsafe sex if they're not admitting that they are gay.
Yeah, I mean, this doesn't go directly to Ward's or Silver's research, but I do think there's some public health research basically showing that people who are more open and, you know, for lack of a better word, honest about their sexuality are probably generally more likely to engage in safe sex.
And so these guys who were interviewed for this study, Tony Silva's study, did they talk politically at all about how they view gay rights?
There's nothing about that in this particular study. What was interesting is, like, one of them used a homophobic slur. Another one of them talked about, I think, sissies and sort of femme gay guys. They seem to look down on the mainstream gay community.
Well, thank you so much.
Hey, thanks for having me.
That's Jesse Single. He's a writer at large for New York Magazine, where you can read his article and find the original study. And we know you want to weigh in on this one. What do you think? Does it matter whether men identify as gay or straight? Let us know on our Facebook and Twitter at KCRW Press Play. Coming up, holiday movies. There are a lot of them, including a big, sleek sci-fi movie with a controversial plot point.
The production values are lovely, and they have tremendous chemistry together. And then it becomes this really crazy, like, shrieky, silly, over-the-top sci-fi action flick.
We'll have your movie reviews next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Time for our regular weekly feature, New Movie Reviews. We normally do this on Fridays, but tomorrow we're taking the day off and there will be special programming. So, movie reviews today, and it's a big weekend coming up. There is much more out than just the holiday flicks like Office, Christmas Party. such as a retelling of the four-day manhunt for the Boston Marathon bombers and a Martin Scorsese film about the persecution of two Catholic priests in 17th century Japan. Sounds festive. Okay, Christy Lemire and Mary Jedekin are here to talk about these movies and more. Christy, co-host of What the Flick on YouTube. Hi.
Hi, good to see you.
Good to see you. And Mary, host and producer of Fandemonium on HitFix and host of YouTube's Girls on Film. Hello.
Hi.
All right, let's get to those two movies in a minute. But first, Passengers. This is the Chris Pratt, Jennifer Lawrence meet cute. They're on a ship to another planet. They're supposed to hibernate for about a century, but they wake up early.
You know what's going on? Nobody else is awake.
I think something went wrong with the hibernation pods. We woke up too soon. 9 years too soon.
This can't be happening. We have
to... Okay. They can't go back to sleep, though, right?
Once the hibernation pod opens and you're up, you're up.
And then what happens?
And then they have 90 years together to try to survive. Mm-hmm. So that clip didn't really tell us the whole story of why Jennifer Lawrence is awake. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's a spoiler. I think it's out there and folks know why she's awake.
Yeah.
And that is the problematic ethical dilemma that everyone is talking about with this movie instead of how is the movie? I think people have a really serious problem with the fundamental premise of it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, what is that?
Can we say?
Yes.
You want
to
say?
I mean,
you have to
right.
now.
It's a bit of a spoiler, but the reveal is that Chris Pratt's character Jim is an engineer who wakes up early, and he's alone. And he's alone for a long time, save for an android sort of AI bartender played by Michael Sheen, in a very like Lloyd from The Shining kind of scenario. Yeah. Which lends to the creep factor, and I kind of wish they had gone more in that direction of exploring the moon-like elements of this film. When Chris Pratt's character is alone, it's really interesting and compelling because it's how does he keep himself busy on this basically Las Vegas hotel in space. But the problem is that he gets really lonely, and he starts stalking, basically, a woman who's played by Jennifer Lawrence, who's asleep, and he starts going through her files and learning all this stuff about her, and you know, he makes a really bad decision and then hides it.
So he wakes her up.
Which they say pretty early on in the film. I don't think it's a giant spoiler. But,
yeah.
But,
so is this like a Sleeping Beauty thing?
And her name is Aurora.
Yeah.
Yes, thank you. And so
and
the
she's in a casket kind
yes,
of thing.
Yes. Yes.
It's creepy.
But I would say he does struggle with whether to do that, mm-hmm. right? But a lot of people have really had a bad taste in their mouth after this. Like, oh my God, what did he do? And then he gets rewarded for this horrible act. Until then, it's a really beautifully made film. Mm-hmm. It's very glossy and kind of thrilling, and you don't know where it's going. And the production values are lovely, and they have tremendous chemistry together. And then it becomes this really crazy, like, shrieky, silly, over-the-top sci-fi action flick. It becomes something totally noisy and different, and I was just laughing at it. That's what lost me. Not necessarily the ethical problems, mm-hmm. but like it just becomes a different movie and not as good of a movie.
I agree. I would have liked if they actually delved more into the ethical because they kind of touch on it, but they don't really explore it. Then, like Christy said, in the third act, it kind of becomes this bombastic sci-fi action thriller in space. And it would have been nice to see the struggle of the ethics around this decision be explored more because the first half of the film is very restrained. And like Christy said, the production design is stellar and it's, you know, kind of worth seeing on a big screen, but it does devolve.
But Stanley Kubrick, it is not.
Nope.
No.
All right. Moving on to Martin Scorsese, a film called Silence. This stars Andrew Garfield and Adam Driver as 17th century Catholic priests on a mission in Japan to find their mentor.
We must go find Father Ferreira.
This is in your hearts, then, both of you?
Yes.
Then I must trust God has put it down. The moment you set foot in that country, you step into high danger.
Oh my gosh, I feel it. I feel the danger. Is this a scary film?
No, it's a very... It's a quiet film, actually, which is fitting given the name. And it's interesting because it asks a lot of very universal questions about faith. But in that universality, it's not a very accessible film. And I think that's maybe one of the challenges of Silence. It's beautiful. And I have to give credit to the cinematographer Rodrigo Prieto, who also shot Wolf of Wall Street, and Dante Ferretti, who's a production designer, who both did an incredible job of building out a world that is very immersive and beautiful and very naturalistic. Interestingly enough, for a film about faith and about the Christian faith to be so kind of preoccupied with the natural setting and the earth and the grass and the fog. And it's very beautiful visually, of course. It's Scorsese.
Yeah.
But it is not for everyone. And I think you can see that in the reviews. There are people who think this is a masterpiece, and there are people who are having a harder time with it, who feel like maybe it's not relevant. I actually think it is quite a relevant film when you think about the questions it asks and where we are right now in popular culture and in the culture of faith and religion. And there are some very harrowing scenes of torture. There's a lot to see, but I don't think it's for everyone. It's long, it's slow, it's quiet. If that's your kind of thing, if you're a fan of Scorsese's more religious films like Kundun or Last Temptation of Christ, this is right up your alley.
Well, speaking of that was pretty controversial. Is this being criticized for any sort of anti-religious sentiment?
Or? No, quite the opposite. I would say this is the most beautifully made faith-based film we've ever seen. The problem with so many faith-based films is they have lousy production values and they get directors who don't know what they're doing and they look really cheap. And this is sumptuous and the lighting is wondrous, like in the big landscapes, but also in really intimate moments, like just the subtle lighting. Andrew Garfield and Adam Driver have wonderful chemistry with each other. They're like best friends and they're priests and they're in this together. But and even in the harrowing moments, it's still gorgeous to look at. It's ultimately very faith affirming.
Mm,
I mean, but it does present relatable questions, no matter what is your religious persuasion or even if you have none.
All right, let's talk about Fences quickly. This is with Denzel Washington and Viola Davis, both getting Oscar buzz for this. It's adapted from the play by August Wilson. It's about race and struggles in a black family in mid-century America in Pittsburgh.
A man is supposed to take care of his family. You live in my house, fill your belly with my food, put you behind on my bed because you're my son. It's my duty to take care of you. I owe a responsibility to you. I ain't got to like you.
Right, he's talking to his son there. What did you think, Christy?
It's a lot of big acting. It's capital A acting. Mm-hmm. Denzel and Viola bouncing off each other. It is so magnetic, electric. It's exciting. It's beautifully acted. But also, like, they do bring it down. It's not all big. Mm-hmm. Viola made me cry many times. And it sticks the landing. The ending is perfect. It's a hard thing to do. Denzel has built it out just enough beyond the borders of being an actual play on film, just enough, but the theatricality of the writing.
He's directed it as well.
Yes, yeah. The theatricality of the writing is very clear, and the cadence of it as a play is very clear, and that's not such a bad thing.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I thought the performances were incredible, but when you think about the fact that Viola Davis and Denzel Washington did this play on Broadway 114 times,
right.
It's understandable.
They have it down.
They really know the parts inside and out. For me, Viola Davis stole the show. Maybe because I'm a woman and I'm a mother, obviously with very different circumstances, a very different time in this country, but she is just so unbelievable in this film. Her performance is understated. It's quiet. It's explosive. It's beautiful. It's very nuanced. And like Christy said, you will cry. I mean, she has this connective ability to really bring you into her experience. And I think what Denzel did well as a director is he made the spaces small. Like, he shot in a real house in Pittsburgh, and you can feel that claustrophobia and probably what Viola's character Rose was experiencing as a woman in mid-century America, as an African-American woman. You feel that sense of enclosure that she's almost like caged, and it's very effective. But I agree, it's you know, someone said to me, this is the film that wins the award for the most acting, because it is very, some of the performances are larger than life.
Okay, another film that's timely, Patriots Day. Look at the 4 days following the Boston Marathon bombing, starring Mark Wahlberg and Kevin Bacon. Mary, what did you think?
You know, Patriots Day, it might be too soon. There's been some criticism from actually critics in Boston who feel that this is a propaganda film and that it's, utilizing a fictional character played by Mark Wahlberg to solve all the problems and, you know, figure out who these bad guys are, when in reality there were a lot of real people, real heroes that he would have liked to have seen, celebrated. And I think it's an interesting film right now. I think given what's going on politically and with what's just happened in Berlin, I don't know that this is enough of an escape for people at the holiday time when there's been so much bad news. But insofar as like a rousing, kind of inspiring, yay, go Boston, Boston strong, it's,
Yeah. Okay.
Worth it.
All right. All right, a new Mike Mills film. He's known for Thumbsucker and Beginners, two movies. This one is called 20th Century Women. It's about a teenage boy surrounded by three females figuring out love in Southern California in the Carter era.
It's 1979 in Santa Barbara, and Annette Bening runs this house, like a boarder house. She's taken boarders to make money. And she has this 15-year-old son she is raising, and she encourages the women who live there to help raise him. And they have really different experiences and perspectives. And it's kind of a episodic little movie. Like, mm-hmm. this nice thing happens, and then this nice thing happens. And then by the end, it sneaks up on you. And the cumulative effect is that you have really spent time with these rich characters in this really vividly drawn place. And Annette Bening is just lovely in it. This movie is very unpredictable. If you ever saw Mike Mills' Beginners, that is inspired by his dad. And this is sort of inspired by his mom. Mm-hmm. And it's clear how personal this is, given how intricately these women are drawn and how complex the situation is. There's no types here, no cookie cutters, no formula.
Yeah, I agree. And I think, you know, in addition to Annette Bening being just a live wire and so much fun to watch, I think Greta Gerwig gives a performance of her life. She's incredible. I loved this movie. This, for me, I loved the fact that it didn't really follow a traditional structure, that it really was kind of a character piece. And I think what's really interesting about it is the exploration of time and the way that Mike Mills kind of takes this very small window of time and the way he frames it with narration. And I don't want to say too much because you should just see it, but he plays with past and present and how we think about people who are no longer with us, or how we think about people when we remember them, particularly a strong, opinionated mother. And he really also focuses on the fact that this is a woman who grew up in the Depression, and now she's living in late 70s Santa Barbara, where everything and anything goes. We're living in a punk era. We're living in a feminist era. And it's about how she is managing the world around her. And she's this chain-smoking, kind of hard-boiled woman who says what's on her mind. And she's a single mother. And I think it's timeless in that way. And I really enjoyed it. I like Mike Mills, but I really like this movie.
Okay. Finally, another movie with a mother character, but one who's dying. And also Liam Neeson.
Oh my God.
He's everywhere. He's everywhere. This one's called A Monster Calls. And this is about a boy whose mom, played by Felicity Jones, she's terminally ill. He's bullied at school. And so he escapes into fantasy and invents this big monster. Here's a clip.
He called for a monster.
Okay, what did you think, Christy?
It's beautiful. Bring Kleenex. Bring the whole box.
Just the trailer made me cry.
There's no shame. Well, it's a dying mother's story, but it's also it's about this rich fantasy life that this kid has. And the connection he has with the tree in the backyard comes to life and becomes this monster. And it's so tactile, and it keeps changing, and the effects are just spectacular. And these animated segments where he learns these stories are just beautifully drawn. But there's also great realism of the situation he is in when his mom is dying and he's forced to live with his grandmother, played by Sigourney Weaver, who is very stern. And it just feels really true despite the really outlandishly fantastical elements to it.
Yeah, I love the fact that it sort of explores grief through the eyes of a very creative child who's an outcast at his school and he doesn't really fit in anywhere. And his one person in his life who really understands him is his mother, who's also an artist and creative. And, you know, we're watching her fade away as he kind of utilizes his imagination to figure out his way around the loss of his mother. And it's fascinating, and it's definitely heart pulling. It pulls at the heartstrings, mm-hmm. but it doesn't ever really feel contrived or cloying, which can often be the case with these kinds of films. They feel like they're really trying hard to make you cry. This one is just like effortless sobbing. You're just going to sob. You're not even going to stop. I mean, it's just beautiful. And Felicity Jones, I think, is wonderful here. And this newcomer, the boy who plays Connor, is incredible. And it's just a great film. I think a lot of family members can enjoy it. Maybe not little ones, but certainly kids of a certain age.
Okay, so it looks like we're going to be crying in the movie Plex this weekend. Thank you.
Merry Christmas.
Yeah. Ho. Christy Lemire, co-host of What the Flick on YouTube. Mary Jettikin, host and producer of Fandemonium on HitFix, and the host of Girls on Film on YouTube. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. A little more than a year ago, Santa Clarita resident Xanthi Pajarillo stood before her local city council and delivered a passionate plea for help. Her cause? The return of the McRib, as in McDonald's McRib. The traditionally seasonal item had not appeared at any Santa Clarita McDonald's, and she was desperate. Ultimately, Pajarillo, a CalArts student, was driven to measures beyond simply petitioning local government. But just in time for this year's holidays, pork appeared at the end of the tunnel. Reporter Peter Gilstrap checked in with her to find out if it was all worth the effort.
To be honest, the removal of the McRib from the menu has affected my family because every Thanksgiving, my family would order a 50-piece chicken McNugget and 10 McRibs. It was like a tradition. And now it's like my family's holiday spirit's kind of messed up and broken.
That's Pajarillo speaking to the city council last November. She wore a black suit and tie and enormous lens crafters glasses. She carried a backpack slung over her shoulder. Her hair was pink.
To me, Thanksgiving for my family without this McRib is like a Christmas without snow. It just doesn't make sense.
Video of the meeting took off on the internet, and Pajarillo became known as the McRib Girl. Blog posts appeared, articles were written, comments were made. Most were positive, but others claimed she was simply a troll or a performance artist, and that her love for the McRib was a lie. Was it all a big joke?
No, like, I understand why people think that because they think, well, first of all, the way I look, I feel like that's a big thing. You see a tiny Asian girl with pink hair bringing up this issue that on the surface seems really silly because they don't know the entire story.
The McRib story begins in 1981, 8 years before Pajarillo was born.
What'd you say this was again?
McDonald's calls it the McRib sandwich. It's a new kind of cue.
McRib? I don't see any bones.
Hey, who wants bones in a sandwich?
That commercial introduced the ground pork invention to the world. Since then, it's been an elusive, teasing delight, appearing on menus only seasonally and sometimes not at all. But the McRib has developed a cult following, and from Last Week Tonight to The Simpsons to The Larry Sanders Show, it's become a touchstone of pop culture.
The death penalty is like the McRib. When you can't have it, it's so tantalizing. But as soon as they bring it back, you think this is ethically wrong.
One ribwich, please. Mm-hmm. Now without lettuce.
Sir, are you all right?
I have eaten the ribs of God.
Who's this?
That's the great Winona Ryder. She's on tonight's show.
Great booking.
And like the limited McRib sandwich, scrumptious, hot, and hard to get.
But for Pajarillo, the McRib is more than a sitcom gag. Her story begins in a magical land where the savory offering is served all year round.
Started actually way back when I was in Germany.
That's right, Germany, where the proud schnitzel's tangy American cousin McRib is beloved. Pajarillo's parents had emigrated from the Philippines to the States. Her father joined the army and brought the family along when he was stationed overseas.
My mom started working at the German McDonald's as a food prep, and my first memories were of her giving us free McRibs and everything. So it kind of started from there and became this family thing throughout the years.
And then came the holidays of 2015.
And I said, okay, finally we can all sit down together. So I was like, okay, this year we're going to have the McRib.
But there would be no McRib.
That year it really affected us. It was building up to this moment where we were going to share together. It felt like something was missing, and it felt less special because of that.
Crestfallen and desperate, that's when Pajarillo, an Air Force veteran herself, took her grievance to local government.
And I went to the city council because maybe somebody in the audience or someone on the council would know somebody in McDonald's and kind of forward it to them.
But does anybody really know anybody at McDonald's? Nobody knew anyone at McDonald's. I called the company's marketing director for the Southern California region, Max Gallegos. He told me that McRib availability, a decision that affects so many lives, is up to, quote, the specific market as a whole. In Southern California, that's some 800 restaurants. a mighty wall of golden arches for one young woman to scale.
When I was trying to get a hold of them last year, it was really hard. They were just passing me down to the lowest customer service people.
So Pajarillo looked to a higher source of vision.
And it's hard, it's hard, it's hard, it's hard, it's a hard rain is gonna fall.
I was inspired by the social movement changes of the 60s when Bob Dylan and like Woody Guthrie would perform, so I felt like that was a way to do it.
'Cause we have a right to eat what we like. A crib is worth the fight.
When the YouTube video of her song McRib Blues got nowhere, Pajarillo staged a non-violent protest in front of a McDonald's in Santa Clarita. She put tape over her mouth. A man dressed as a cow joined her. But not even the police showed up. She turned it all into a documentary, got some more attention, but still, the McRib was a ghost in the wind. And then...
I'm Diana Felza with Features and Faces on FoxNews.com. Are you ready for the return of the McRib?
No less a source than Fox News announced the return of the McRib to Santa Clarita, including a new app to help people find the McRib. It was called the McRib Finder. And so this holiday season, the McRib has returned. McDonald's acknowledged Pajarillo's efforts, even inviting her to perform at a local franchise. Xanthi and her family had their traditional 10 McRibs for Thanksgiving, but perhaps most of all, she says she learned something and just maybe made a difference.
You know, when you stand up for something that's viewed as like really dumb or trivial and other people don't agree with it, you tend to listen to the negative voice in your head like, oh, maybe I shouldn't talk about it because there's so much judgment. But even though we disagree on things, why can't we just support each other in this and stop all the hate?
A worthy question indeed. All we can do is see what happens next year. Are you listening, McRib? For KCRW, I'm Peter Gilstrap. In Santa Clarita.
All right, Christian Bordahl here with the listener feedback. Hi there.
Hey, Madeline. Well, you discussed a little earlier a study about men who have sex with other men but identify as straight.
Uh-huh.
And unsurprisingly, we got some thoughts on our Facebook page about that. Michael Rababy wrote, alt-straight. Jen Downwoods wrote, are their wives okay with this? It sounds hypocritical that they get to dabble in the homosexual realm but remain homophobic. Another aspect of white privilege, perhaps. Nicholas Harson wrote, men having sex with men equals capital G-A-Y. Any other self-label is self-loathing and a marginalization of the humanity we all share. And finally, Jay Reed wrote, there's a line between just sex and sexual identity. Merely having sex with the same gender doesn't make you gay or even bi. The fact that these particular men were using homophobic language and asserting or reaffirming their straightness makes me believe they're struggling with personal identity issues rather than simply being sexual beings. So people are having some thoughtful thoughts about that particular topic.
I would say there are lots of identity questions in that piece.
Yes,
for sure.
Indeed. And now we get to go off to the holidays and think more deeply about them.
I know. Well, happy holidays to you.
Same to you, Madeline.
Enjoy your well-deserved break.
Oh, yes, I will.
And we're going to be on tape tomorrow, the best of, or some of our best of.
The greatest hits.
A few of our greatest hits.
2016.
We will have that for you tomorrow, and then we have special programming next week. I'm Madeline Brand. Have a fantastic holiday. I'll see you in the new year.
Support for Press Play comes from the Kane Foundation, Rick and Suzanne Kane, and Jenny, Maggie, and Sari Kane.